Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Saturday, September 6th, 2008, and this is show number 168. Did you notice I said Saturday? I'm actually recording an entire day early because tomorrow I'm headed off to the demo conference in San Diego. Chris Shipley, who runs it, actually invited me to be her guest at the conference. I met her at the All Things Digital conference in May. Boondoggle, boondoggle, boondoggle. No, I met her at this very important conference I went to, and she invited me to come, and she actually invited me to the VIP dinner the night before it starts, where all of the CEOs of the companies are going to be there that'll be demonstrating their new products. Not 100% sure exactly what the show is going to be like, is going to be about, but they actually, from what I can read online, companies demonstrate their software tools, websites, to Web 2.0 kind of stuff, and hardware products, but they each only get 6 minutes to do the presentation. So I guess it's just like, bam, 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 you know, you're going through listening to all this stuff. I think it's mostly for venture capitalists, and the people who present pay an enormous sum. I read online it was $18,000 to get to present on stage. Anyway, it should be pretty interesting. I read online on CNET's website that Natalie Del Conte will be there interviewing folks, so I hope to meet her. That would really be fun. I think she's a lot of fun. I've seen her on Cranky Geeks a few times, and I really liked her. She's really smart and really cute and just like, yeah, it just seems really fun. Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher of the Wall Street Journal are supposed to do some big battle on stage this year, so that ought to be fun. Well, by the way, I am doing this live on Ustream again, like we have been doing for quite a while now, and have a bunch of people having fun in the chat room. But I'm also recording it. So if you're really bored and want to listen to the whole darn thing again, you can actually get all the pieces in between where I goof around or I look over and I see that Bart's going, ooh, ooh, you made a mistake. You made a mistake. Back up, back up. And you can go back and watch the recording. It should be at ustream.tv/nosilicast. Well, I had the most fun discussion ever about TCP/IP yesterday. I mean, way more fun than you can even imagine. I mean, it's a hot topic anyway, but it was so much fun. Anyway, remember last week when Rod told us about how he spoofed the MAC address of his PC onto his Mac when he was at a hotel so both could get online without paying the hotel twice? Well, I thought that was really a slick little way of doing things, and I happened to tell the story to two of my Unix buddies at work. They were both intrigued by how this could work. They thought something should go wrong. Not that you couldn't spoof a MAC address. We all knew that could be done. But they wondered, what would the network do if you had two machines with the same MAC address making requests to the internet, and how would the packets come back and understand where to go? I know that the way Rod actually did it was one at a time on a wired connection, but we kind of thought it'd be fun to extrapolate and ask what would happen if he were using a wireless connection and he got them both on the network at the same time. There ensued a long discussion of packets and hardware layer versus IP layer, and there was some UDP thrown in there, and oh, we just had a blast. We probably talked about it for an hour. Now, my contention was that since the router using NAT, or network address translation, would know which computer to send the returning information from the web to because it looks at the IP address first. So if you have two IP addresses, 101 and 102, 101 makes the request, it goes out through the router, and when it comes back, it knows to send it to 101. It doesn't look at the MAC address, it looks at the IP address, is what I thought NAT did. The other guys seemed to think that maybe the MAC address would actually confuse things because maybe both computers would get the message. The question was, what would happen to the one that had the wrong IP address? Would it drop the packet gracefully, or would it, you know, barf? What would happen? Well, we really couldn't decide either way. That's when I realized that I actually know one of the authors of Network Address Translation. His name is Chuck Mott, and he's the nicest guy in the world. I knew he'd have fun with us, whether he knew the answer or not. So we rang up old Chuck and had a great time walking through all the scenarios. What was even more fun was that he said we had gone beyond the edge of his knowledge level with this question. I thought that was really cool. Now, what I'm waiting for is Monday morning to find out whether he went home and experimented. I have a half a mind to try it myself, and most certainly probably booger my network for days. Don't tell Steve I'm thinking about doing this. I don't know if he'd like it if I was doing that. One of my favorite parts of the discussion, though, was when he went through in his own head, he was kind of walking through what would happen to the two computers, and he said, I wonder if the wrong one would just drop it or puke. I cracked up because, of course, I had said barf when I was talking to the guys about it. And here he comes back and says, would it puke? I liked it. That means I'm almost as smart as Chuck Mott. Well, in case you want to check my story, I put a link in the show notes to the man pages on NatD or Network Address Translation Daemon, where Chuck is credited as one of the authors. The particular one I found was in the man pages at developer.app.com. I'm sorry, developer.apple.com for NatD. Well, this week, the interwebs are all a Twitter about Google Chrome. By the way, do you think Twitter's origins came from that phrase, all a Twitter? Or maybe it came from Twitterpated? I've kind of always wondered that. Well, anyway, everybody's all excited that Google came out with a new browser called Chrome. Let me say first that I don't entirely get why we need another browser, but Google frequently surprises me with their absolute genius, so I'm not going to question that. The other thing, though, is I think it's criminal that they did not come out with a Linux and Mac version on the same day, but instead said, later. Well, in this case, I actually do trust them that they will do it later, but still, that was kind of mean. But anyway, those two issues aside, I loaded Chrome up on my Windows laptop along with IE8 Beta 2 this week, and I had some fun. One of the cool things about Chrome is that if a tab crashes, the other tabs actually stay live. They're actually separate processes. Now, Paul Thurrott of the surprisingly good podcast Windows Weekly, yeah, I like to keep up even though I have an ever so slight Macintosh bias, I actually really like Windows Weekly. Anyway, Paul Thurrott said that IE8 also runs each tab as a process, so if one tab crashed, the other ones wouldn't. But I don't think he's right, because 3 times in 3 days, I had full crashes of IE8, including turning my entire screen white so I could not do anything until I launched the task manager to kill it. When I went into the task manager, there was only one instance of IE8 in there to kill, so I'm not sure what he was talking about. I didn't see a bunch of IE8s and some way to tell them apart and to kill one. So I don't know if he's right. In contrast, Chrome ran error-free for those same 3 days. There were some Java things it couldn't do, and I'm not really clear always on which one's Java and which one's JavaScript, and I know that Chrome is supposed to be better for JavaScript, so it must have been a Java thing, but some Java stuff wouldn't run. I'm not sure if I have to like reinstall Java to make it go, but I heard there was something it can't do. I do really, really like Chrome, though, for a bunch of things. First, you can run an incognito window where every tab you open in there and everything you do in there leaves no trace on the computer you're working on. You know, not that I would do anything I have to hide, but, you know, it's kind of nice to have that option once in a while. I mean, you know, like, let's say I were, shopping for a Christmas present for Steve. I wouldn't want him to be able to find it in the cache. You know? Yeah, that kind of thing. Well, anyway, I love the way Chrome animates real time when you shrink or grow a window. Normally on a browser, as you say, grab the top. And I love, by the way, that Windows lets you grab any side to change the size of a window. It's the stupid Mac way where you got to drag it, slide the corner, drag it, slide the corner. Anyway, over on Windows, when you grab the top, say in IE8, you just see kind of a line coming down. Then when you let go, it snaps and everything, you know, shrinks to the right size. But in Chrome, when you shrink or grow the window, all of the text does its wrapping real time and the graphics are moving real time as you're changing the size of the window. It's really very cool. It feels very smooth. The biggest thing, though, is the height from the top of the real content down, up to the top of the window is very, very short. Very little space is wasted up there, especially compared to IE8. Now, I'm really sensitive to this for a couple of reasons. Well, for one main reason, I work on a widescreen laptop. So spare height in screen space is the one thing you do not have in that scenario. And a lot of us work that way. We use online meetings at work where someone will be screen sharing. And the other day, I was looking at one where the other person was running PowerPoint. So I've got it up in IE8. So if you take the height of the top part of IE8, plus the Lotus Same Times tabs, plus the PowerPoint menu slop. And by the way, they weren't in the new PowerPoint. If they'd been in PowerPoint 2007, it would have been even bigger, that stupid ribbon. Just with those, it was 4 inches of screen space taken up. 4 inches. I'm not kidding you. I got out a ruler and measured it on my screen. I lost 4 inches of screen space before I could get to the stinking content. Anyway, I took some screenshots of Chrome versus Firefox versus IE8 of just that height I'm talking about, and I'll put that in the show notes. Both Firefox and Chrome were very similar, and both much, much smaller than IE8. Well, another really cool feature of Chrome is that you can create web applications. They're really a lot like the Fluid applications Bart's always talking about. So, for example, you navigate to Gmail, and then in the menu, you click on Make New Application window, and then it puts an icon on your desktop that takes you straight to Gmail. So if you double-click that icon, you go into Gmail, and it doesn't really feel like you're in a web browser at all. You don't have a back and forward button or any of those things at all. It's just Gmail. It's really, really slick. Let's see, there's one major thing missing right now that they've got to work on is you can't actually manage your bookmarks. Like, you can't go in and rename them or delete them. You can add more, I think, but I don't think you can do anything else to them. Obviously, that's something that's got to come along that seems like a small thing to go do. Well, I'll be talking a lot more about Chrome in the future as I play with it. So far, it's really fun, and it's been distracting me from doing real constructive work, so that's always good. In the meantime, if you want to watch some little videos, I put a link to the Chrome Features site on Google that has these quick little videos to show you how it works. Each one is like 15 seconds long, or you can click a button to see all 10 of them. Well, remember last week? I have a little bit of a correction here. Remember last week I said PicLens used to be called Cool Iris Previews. And then I said, but they called it PicLens. Sometimes it's Cool Iris Previews, but I didn't understand what the difference was. Well, I launched Firefox the other day, and it did an update on me to 3.0 beta 4, or 3.0 B4, and suddenly PicLens didn't work. I was furious. I just got addicted to PicLens. I wanted PicLens. So I went up to add-ons, I typed in PicLens, and it found Cool Iris Previews and installed it. So now I'm in business again. But then I was kind of confused because I thought PicLens was the new name and Cool Iris Previews was the old name, but now I'm getting Cool Iris Previews when they said PicLens was old. I'm so confused. But anyway, with Cool Iris Previews, I actually got more capability in it. For example, I clicked on David Roth's picture in Twitter.com, and it brought up his Twitter page in a little window. Turns out there's a little magnifying icon that lets you, if you click on that, it brings up a little tiny web page so you can take a look and see if it's what you want. I remember that's what Cool Iris Previews did ages and ages ago. So I'm a little bit confused now of which one's which, but I know that I really, really like it, whatever it is called. I have been working with it, and one of the things I did upcoming in the show is going to be Donald Burr's review of the Canon G9, and I wanted to see what the G9 looked like. So I went to Google Images, and I typed in Canon PowerShot G9, and it brought up a bunch of thumbnails. But then I went into the preview thing for the photos, and every one of the thumbnails actually, as you went through them, turned into the real image behind the thumbnails. So instead of having to click through to see if you were finding a big one or a small one, they all came up beautifully on screen. It was just fantastic. Well, remember last week on Chit Chat Across the Pond, Bart was coming up with all these lame reasons why iChat isn't as good as Adium, and I kept telling him Adium or iChat rocks. Well, one of his lame reasons was that iChat used bubbles for the chats. I'm not sure what he has against bubbles. Maybe he had a childbirthing episode with some bubbles one time. Well, whatever. Well, Ben sent in an email where he said, "I just felt compelled to make a correction. Bart was saying how he hates bubbles in iChat. All you have to do is right-click or control-click on a chat window to change it from bubbles to something else. Hope this helps, Ben." Well, I tested out Ben's excellent tip, and it turns out you can choose boxes, compact, or text instead of those nasty, scary bubbles. Well, I put screenshots of the three options in the show notes so you can choose for yourself which one you like. Thanks, Ben, for taking my side in the latest debate. Well, Victor Cahiao of The Typical Mac User does a fantastic podcast, and it was even more fantastic this week because he had Ladies Night on The Typical Mac User. Somehow he missed the memo that I'm no lady, but I guess I snuck in on a technicality, and he let me contribute to his show. Head on over to typicalmacuser.com or follow the link in the show notes to the Ladies Night episode of The Typical Mac User to check it out. I think I'm about two-thirds of the way into the show, and of course it's, you know, the best part of the show.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Peter Boots is back with another great installment in our Dumb Question Corner series. Here's his entry for this week. "Hi, Allison. My dumb question for this week. Can I make a smart folder in iPhoto that shows me just all of the movie files that I've imported? I can't seem to set it that way. Greets, Peter. Well, Peter, you know I'm not a big iPhoto fanatic, but this seemed like a fun thing to hunt for, so I set aside my convictions and I popped open iPhoto. I selected File, New Smart Album. Up came the options to set conditions for the Smart Album. My first idea was to set the left pull-down to File Name, the second to Contains, and then I typed in .avi in the third field. Suddenly, all of the AVIs from my digital camera were all there in one Smart Album. Well, I actually sent that off to Peter, and he said, thanks, that sort of works, but what if I have different movie file types? Okay, take it up a notch to challenge two. I went back in and poked around, and I found the solution in the dumbest option. I thought maybe I could set the left pull-down to, say, file type, but that wasn't an option. They did have an option that said photo. So on a lark, I set the left column to photo, and and then I used the third pull-down, and it turns out it gives you the choice of flagged, hidden, edited, raw, or movie. All you have to do is tell iPhoto to set the filter to photo is movie. Right. Sounds like something the people who wrote Lotus would have the menus go to, doesn't it? Well, anyway, if you set the photo to be movie, there's all of your movies in one Smart Album. What a great question, Peter. I really enjoyed that. Well, Jude sent in his very first recording, and he's got a style that is, well, different. I think you'll enjoy both his style, and hopefully you'll help me answer his question, too, because he's pretty much got me stumped.
Hi, Allison. This is Jude, a technology geek with an ever-so-slight Allison bias. My question has to do with the Apple keyboard, the full-size aluminum keyboard I bought as an accessory for my MacBook Pro, though I imagine it applies to any Apple full-size keyboard. I have a distinct distaste for the mousy touchpads and tiny keyboards that come with laptops. So ever since day one, I've used a full-size mouse and a full-size keyboard whenever I work on a laptop. Also, my background is with Windows, going all the way back to version 1.0, and over the years, I've developed certain skills with the full-size keyboard while working with Windows. I can't touch type, but over the years, I've developed certain skills using certain keys that get certain functions done under Windows. For example, Shift-Delete, Shift-Insert, Page-Up, Page-Down, End-Home, and all those other key combinations allow me to navigate rather quickly through the Windows environment. And last but not least, I use those special keys on the numeric keypad only. I don't use that little grouping of keys that appears between the normal alphanumeric keyboard and the numeric keypad, but I use the numeric keypad with numlock always off. I am a big anti-numlock person, and for what it's worth, I get the job done, whether it's writing code for a web page or a letter to Santa Claus. Imagine my surprise when I tried to navigate the same way on the MacBook Pro using the full-size keyboard. I didn't. I couldn't. For whatever reason, Steve Jobs has decided not to put a numlock or a numunlock on his keyboard. He's deprived me of my arrow keys, my page up, my page down, and the other certain keys that I need to do my shift copies and shift inserts and shift deletes and all the other stuff. And as my MacBook Pro had been my first Apple computer ever, you can imagine my disappointment. Parenthetically, even though I still have to do an awful lot of work on Windows machines, the reason I made the jump to a Mac is twofold. Reason number one, Vista. Reason number two, that utterly worthless cartoon that appears at the top of every Office 2007 application screen called the Ribbon Bar. If Microsoft is not going to take their applications seriously, then neither am I. So my dumb question, dear Allison, is this. Is there anything I can do, either firmware-wise, hardware-wise, software-wise, is there any Einstein out there who has written anything that would allow me, while operating under Leopard on my MacBook Pro, to emulate my beloved numlock off status, just like I had in Windows, to where I can do things like page up, page down, shift copy, shift insert, yada, 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 all the stuff at which I was great on a PC keyboard. Thanks, Allison.
Well, great recording and question, Jude. The intro was fantastic. Your comments on Vista and Office 2007 are sublime. And your question was fascinating. The bad news is that I hunted everywhere for an answer and I did not find one. I found a ton of people explaining that the clear key does NumLock, but it only works if you're in boot camp on the Mac, so you have to be running Windows for that to work. I did dig out my husband's old aluminum key extended keyboard. You know, the one I poured beer into and I cheered with excitement when the Mars Phoenix landed safely and I had to buy him a new one because the space bar stayed really sticky. Yeah, that's the one. Anyway, I plugged that into my MacBook Pro. I tried every key combination I could think of to get that clear key to do anything but beep at me. I even held down keys on the MacBook Pro keyboard while hitting clear on the extended keyboard. I also tried the NumLock key on the MacBook Pro keyboard, which is function F6, by the way. And while that annoyingly turns your J into a 1, your K into a 2, and so on, it had no effect on the extended keyboard. Well, I wrote all of this in an email to Jude, and I asked him another question. Here's what I wrote. Can I ask you one thing, Jude? If you've banished Windows from your life, would it be a possibility to learn to use the page up, page down buttons that are in between the numeric keyboard and the keypad? I know, it's new and scary, but maybe it's time to move on, Jude. I'll give you a couple of fun keyboard shortcuts. Put your cursor at the front of a line and hit Command Right Arrow, which says End on the MacBook Pro keyboard. That'll take you to the end of a line. Command Down takes you to the bottom of the page. Isn't that fun? And this is when Jude raised his rank from the merely interesting podcast listener and contributor to his new title of Nutball Jude. I don't want you to confuse that with crazy listener James. I don't think Jude is certifiable. He's just nutty. Here's what he wrote back. For hands, I have two hams. For fingers, 10 kielbasa. See actual Polaroid of my fingers below. It's difficult to place them precisely or even imprecisely on that tiny area between the alphanumeric keyboard and the numeric keypad. I put the picture of his fingers in the show notes so that you can see for yourself just how off his rocker Jude actually is. Now that I think about it, maybe he is crazy. Maybe he needs to join go into the asylum with listener James. I'm not sure. Well, it doesn't matter. He makes really great recordings and asks good questions. But back to the real problem. How do we get NumLock on an extended keyboard attached to a MacBook Pro? I found a ton of references to using the clear key, like I said, but since it only works in boot camp, that doesn't help him. The only idea I have left in my brain is to do a key remapping to map the clear key to NumLock. But I don't actually know how to do that, but I think you can, right? Can someone please help kielbasa-fingered nutball Jude out there? Let me know. Well, good friend of the show Donald Burr is back with his great review of the Canon G9 camera. Sit back and enjoy.
Hi, Donald Burr here again from Otaku No Podcast and a brand new podcast, which I just recently started. More on that later. I'm here today to review the Canon PowerShot G9 point-and-shoot camera. My photographic needs have reached a point where I'm not really satisfied with the typical point-and-shoot camera. I still take quite a few snapshotty-type pictures, but after starting to listen to the really cool photography podcasts like This Week in Photography, or the Chris Marquardt segments on Leo's Tech Guy radio show, I want to start doing more with my photographs. Also, ever since I saw a demonstration on Apple's Aperture program, I really want to start shooting RAW because that offers the most tweakability in terms of being able to fix problems and really getting the most out of your photograph. Now, I have a typical point-and-shoot camera. It's a cheaper Canon PowerShot, but I also have a Digital Rebel. This is the original Digital Rebel, digital SLR. The problem with that, though, is that I never had the thing when I wanted to take that really cool picture, because the DSLR is so big, I just can't carry it with me. So I've been looking for a camera that offers the portability and spontaneity of a point-and-shoot, but that can offer me a level of creative control similar to what I can get on a DSLR. And I believe I've found that camera in the Canon PowerShot G9. The G9 is about the size of a large-ish point-and-shoot camera, 4.2 inches by 2.8 inches by 1.7 inches. It weighs 320 grams, or about 11.3 ounces. So it's fairly hefty, but not overly so. It feels really good in the hand, and it includes a little rubber nub that you can use to grab onto it. It fit my average-sized hands pretty well, but if you have really large hands, or if you're wearing gloves, like if you're shooting in the snow or something, I could see that you might have a problem holding onto it. Like I said, the unit's fairly hefty. That's primarily because it's almost all metal constructed. There's only one small plastic panel on the top. It's very solidly built. In fact, I had an unfortunate opportunity to test its build quality just a few days after I got it, because I dropped it from about chest height onto concrete, and it survived. Unfortunately did not survive unscathed. It has a few lovely battle scars now near the lens area, but the camera works perfectly, so it survived the drop test. Fortunately, the lens has an automatically retracting lens cover, so the actual lens part was protected during my little mishap. It's small enough to fit in my jacket pocket or my backpack, so it fits my easy portability category perfectly. Unfortunately, this camera uses a proprietary battery pack, but they're pretty readily available and not that expensive. It takes a little over an hour and a half to charge, and it lasts for about 240 shots on average, which is not bad, all things considered. But if you're going out for a long weekend of shooting, where you'll be away from power for a long time, you should probably get a second battery pack to have on hand. It takes SD memory cards and works with the newer SDHC high-capacity cards, which are now available in 8GB, 16GB, and even bigger coming down the pike, which is great. I really like the LCD screen on this camera. It's 3 inches, and it's super bright, so you can use it in bright sunlight. Of course, you can also dim it, so if you're indoors in low light, you won't get your eyes blasted out by the LCD. And unlike many point-and-shoot cameras, this camera actually has a physical optical viewfinder. You can configure the LCD to display as much or as little information as you like. I find the histogram and the light meter particularly useful. The lens offers a 6x optical zoom, that is, in 35mm equivalent, 35 to 210mm. Aperture can be set anywhere from f2.8 in wide angle, or f4.8 in telephoto, all the way to f8.0. This smallish aperture doesn't give as much creative control as you can get on a digital SLR, with the nice fast lens, but for a point and shoot, it's actually pretty decent, and it can get fairly good results with it. Shutter speeds are available anywhere from 1/2000th of a second all the way up to 15 seconds. The lens features optical image stabilization, which really helps with eliminating blurriness caused by camera shake. For those really close-up pictures, this camera also offers an excellent macro mode. In macro mode, this camera can focus down from 50 centimeters at the telephoto end of the lens all the way down to 1 centimeter at the wide end of the lens. And the flash works beautifully even in macro mode. Actually, the flash on this camera works amazingly well. In typical indoor room photography, everything is perfectly exposed as far as flash photography goes. The cool part is, if you need more specialized flash applications, this camera has an intelligent hot shoe, which means you can attach flash units, including remote control flash units. See, you can get pretty fancy with the flash if the need arises. This camera has 25 shooting modes, including modes that you'd commonly find only on digital SLRs, such as aperture priority, shutter priority, and yes, even a completely full manual mode. The 12.1 megapixel image sensor operates at up to ISO 1600 sensitivity. And this is one of the very few point-and-shoot cameras that shoots in full RAW mode. which means you have complete control once you import your pictures into Photoshop or Aperture or Lightroom or whatever. For me, this was the most important feature of this camera, and that was its main selling point for me. It has a wide range of autofocus modes, including 9-point AI autofocus and face detection, which is very handy when taking those portraits. You can even go into manual focus mode if you want ultimate control. There are a few problems with this camera. The main problem is the small image sensor size. It's only a 1/17-inch sensor, which is supposed to be able to handle 12.1 megapixels. That means that once you get into the high ISO range, you get a lot of noise off your image sensor. I found that if you shoot up to and including ISO 400, you get pretty acceptable results, especially if you're shooting RAW, because once you import your pictures into Adobe Camera Raw or Aperture or whatever, you can use those programs' superior noise reduction and processing algorithms, or an external noise reduction program such as Noise Ninja. Anything ISO 800 and above, though, is almost completely unusable, which is sad, but what can you do? There is also a slight shutter lag when using the LCD, approximately 0.12 seconds, which is fine for most photography, but not too good if you're trying to capture some fast action. Fortunately, this camera does have an optical viewfinder. When you use that, your shutter lag goes down to 0.05 seconds, which is good enough for capturing those fast action shots. The autofocus is also a bit slow in low light or in macro mode, but you can work around that. In general, though, I'm very pleased with this camera. It's solid, built like a rock, and performs well and takes great pictures. I've taken many pictures in both outdoors and indoors conditions, including some low-light pictures, and they've come out looking beautiful. I wasn't expecting the moon. You know, I knew going into this that getting a smaller camera body, I would need to make some trade-offs because, you know, we can't have the big, fast lenses like on a digital SLR. But keeping those trade-offs in mind, I'm still very pleased with the results. The G9 lists for $499, but you can find it online for quite a bit less if you look. I give it a very enthusiastic 4 out of 5. For many more technical details about this camera, as well as some great sample pictures, much better sample pictures than I could possibly provide, check out the review of the G9 on the dpreview.com website. I'm sure Allison will be posting a link to that in the show notes. Now, what is this about a new podcast? Am I crazy? Maybe I am. I don't know. But lately, I've been sucked into a brand new world, an online game called Mabinogi. It's great, but there's precious little information about it online. And no podcasts! Can you believe it? Well, naturally, the crazy fool podcaster in me said, I've got to do something about this. So I've started a new podcast called Voices of Erin. That's Voices of Erin, ERINN.com. All about this great online game called Mabinogi. Yes, it's one of those massively multiplayer online role-playing games, MMORPGs, like World of Warcraft. But it's better. And it's free. Yes, you heard me. Free. Free as in $0, nada, bupkis, etc. Only problem is, it's Windows only. But, hey, it works under Bootcamp. Anyways, check it out, voicesofaaron.com. And now, back to your regularly scheduled MozillaCast. Wait a second. There is one more thing. I got myself a fancy new Linux server over at GoDaddy, and I've moved the websites of all of my podcasts onto it. I was getting kind of fed up with Libsyn's limitations. You know, you can't really do much customization on the websites that they provide you. So I said, okay, that's enough. Got myself a new server, and now I've got set up under WordPress. It's been great. I'm using the PodPress plugin, which is awesome, by the way. And I love it. So check out voicesofaaron.com as well as otakunopodcast.com and see the fancy new websites. Now back to MozillaCast, really, this time.
Well, Donald, I always enjoy your reviews because you do such a good job of explaining the problem you're trying to solve, and then you take a lot of care in identifying both the good and the bad of the products you review. I've heard a lot about the Canon PowerShot G9, and man, everybody seems to love that thing. I put a graphic in the show notes to where you can buy it on Amazon, and of course, if you click that link, at the NoSilicast gets a little extra cashola. But if you don't want it, don't buy it, for heaven's sakes. But you could, of course, click that link and go buy something else on Amazon, and I still get a little tiny, tiny, tiny bit of money. But anyway, you don't have to, but if you want to, do it. I put the links to the DP review on the G9 that Donald talked about. By the way, that's a fantastic site. It's I think it's Digital Photo Review is what it stands for. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, they do a really good job of comparing cameras. If you're looking at a couple of options, it's a really, really great site. Well, Jane from Perth has a great tip for a problem I didn't know you could actually solve.
Hi, Alison. It's Jane. Have you ever been driven totally insane by those snapshots pop-up boxes that appear on some websites? They spring out from the screen when you move your cursor over links on the page you're viewing and block out part of the screen you're trying to read. Well, I recently used Firefox instead of the usual Safari web browser to view my own website, and I was surprised, and yes, irritated, at having advertising pop-up boxes appearing all over my website. These snapshots boxes appear even if you have pop-ups disabled in your web browser options. I had always thought that these boxes were some way that website owners used to create a little bit of income. Well, I certainly wasn't making any money from them and was not even aware that they were plaguing visitors to my website. The purpose of snapshots is to show the viewer a snapshot of the linked page, but to me, they are more of a hindrance than a help. I noticed that at the top of the pop-up box, there was a little cogwheel symbol, which gave you the option to disable them. So I checked the box and so prevented their appearance. But this only stopped them from appearing to me. Others who browsed my site would still be seeing the little critters on their screen. I had a quick search around the settings of my WordPress.com blog, but couldn't see any appropriate settings to alter. And I must admit, the problem then sank to the back of my mind. The problem was dragged sharply back to the front of my mind when Don McAllister of the Screencasts Online podcast told me that those horrible boxes were ruining his viewing of my website. I vowed there and then to rid my site of these pesky annoyances. Now, I am an absolute amateur at websites, and so my site is published by the easiest method possible, that being via the WordPress.com hosting service, which does just about everything for you except produce the content of your pages. And hey, wouldn't it be great if they did that as well? So I trawled around the various Manage Page tabs, Settings and Design sections on my blog. Now, call me stupid if you like, but I just couldn't see how to turn off the pop-ups. So I turned to Google, which quickly produced the answer to my problem. I just needed to go to my WordPress.com dashboard, click on Design, and then the Extras tab, where the words Enable snapshots on this blog loomed large. There was a tick in the box beside them. Aha! Here was the power to prevent the vermin from ever reappearing on my website. I took great pleasure in removing that tick and forever banishing the snapshots pop-up boxes from my website. Now, I am sure I can't be the only blogger who wasn't aware of the snapshots boxes appearing on their website. So, if you have a blog, especially a WordPress.com hosted blog, make sure you are aware of the pop-ups, and if you decide, like me, that they are just an irritation, then disable them by following the instructions on my website at galacticstrings.com, where you can view a video I made showing how to disable the snapshots boxes. Cheers, and see you all next time.
Jane, I really hate those jump-out things coming at me when I hover over things. I didn't even know they were called snapshots. Your instructions are fantastic, and the video is even better that you did over at galacticstrings.com. I went over and watched it to make sure I understood exactly how you fixed it. I checked out my own blog that I host myself with WordPress, and I went to the dashboard, and it turns out the extras tab was not available to me. The WordPress folks must enable that by default for you, and it's, doing this might be a revenue stream for them. You can't really blame them for finding ways to monetize since they did give the service to you for free, but it's really nice that they give you a way to turn it off, and even better that you shared it with everybody else. One thing that strikes me funny as I was thinking about this is that while snapshots really bug the daylights out of me, do you remember I said at the beginning of the show that I really like cool iris previews because it lets me pop out a website without actually visiting it? Just sort of like the same thing. The difference, though, is that I get a magnifying glass that I actively click on to get that pop out. I ask for it. I don't get it accidentally by just kind of dragging my mouse across a word or a link and it flies out at me. It really bugs me that it's on these random words. They're not really links. They're just kind of words and something flies out at you. Really annoying. Thank you so much for this public service announcement, and I'm sure that others will get the benefit from you sharing it. Well, this week a catastrophe struck. Just a little catastrophe. But Lindsay's Honda got smacked in a parking lot. It wasn't that bad. The woman just sort of broke off her side view mirror. But you know how this kind of thing goes, though, right? I mean, as small as it is, it's like this huge hassle. The woman was very nice. She said she'd pay for it and all that. But, you know, it means like a whole bunch of trips to the Honda dealer to take care of it. And, you know, just all the phone calls and trying to figure out what to do. Lindsay's first experience with having to deal with this. Well, even worse, partway through the experience, the lady balked at the price and claimed she could get it much cheaper online. You know, like $40 versus $250. Oh, yeah, that's probably a genuine Honda part, I'm thinking. Well, anyway, Lindsay wasn't sure what she should do about this request from this woman who was going to have to pay for it. You know, she's sympathetic and all, but, you know, $250 versus $40. How do you figure out if the woman's right? What do you think she did? Well, she called Honda Bob, of course. Unfortunately, at this time, she lives too far away for Honda Bob to take care of her personally, but she knew that if she called him, he would tell her the truth. He would advise her and make sure she was taken care of. I love that she had such faith in him. Imagine if you two had that kind of mechanic, someone who you could trust and who would always stand by their work, someone who would come to your house, take care of you the way Honda Bob takes care of our happy little Honda family. Well, you two can have that kind of service if you meet two strict criteria. You have to live in the LA or Orange County area, and you have to drive a Honda or Acura car. That's it. That's all you have to do. So if you live farther away, move. And if you drive another kind of car, sell it. That's all there is to it. Give them a call for your repair and maintenance needs at 562-531-2321, or you can shoot them an email over at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. It's time for an early edition of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from bartbouchatz.ie. How are you today, Bart?
I'm good, and there is absolutely nothing early about this. It is 2:05 in the morning.
No, but it's Thursday. It's not Saturday. That's early.
Well, my little doc says Friday.
Oh, well, that's your problem. It's only 6 at night for me.
Yeah, and another little correction. You now get to say something much shorter. It's from bartb.ie.
BartB.ie, then we don't have to spell Bouchatz?
Yeah.
Oh, that's.
I figured this way someone might actually show up on my website.
BartB.ie. I'm writing it down because I won't be able to. You'll have to correct me for the next 7 or 8 weeks first, though, okay?
Well, I bought a couple, actually. So BartB.me works as well. And one more, BartB.eu.
Oh, nice, nice. Hey, well, I did want to bring up a couple things before we get into our main topic, or one thing. On the Adium versus iChat debate, I've gotten tons and tons of email, and every single person agrees with me.
Well, that makes a nice change, because usually all of your fan mail is the other way around.
I'm lying, of course, but I'm not going to tell you about the ones that agree with you. No, actually, a lot of people are agreeing with me, but I just felt like yanking your chain.
So it must be 50-50.
Yeah. No, it's at least 90-10 in my favor.
Okay.
Well, anyway, what's our topic of the day?
Well, I figured since it's the start of the school year, I might talk a little bit about an alternative to using Microsoft Word for your big, important, you know, theses and write-ups and dissertations and texty what's-its.
What's a good solution for that?
It's a good solution, but it comes with, you know, you get loads of advantages, but there's one drawback. So the one drawback is it's a teeny little bit nerdy and does involve, not having a GUI. But on the plus side, it does loads of things for you. So if you can handle HTML, you can handle this.
Okay. I promised I'd let you describe the problem first, but I just asked you for the solution. So what's the problem we're trying to solve? You got a big paper that's due. What's wrong with Microsoft Word?
Well, apart from the fact that it generally chews things up and then it moves things around and then you have everything done and you write up your little index at the start and then you print it out, and for some magical reason, Word has decided that it's going to add in a page break here, it's going to move a picture there, it's going to change this, it's going to change that, and your index is not up anymore.
Yeah, I do hate that. Hate a bit of that.
Yeah, and you end up having to waste your own time remembering whether you're on section 1.4, and then you add in a section in between 1.4 and 1.5, and then you got to rename everything down below. See, 1.5 becomes 1.6, and the whole thing just gets messed up. So wouldn't it be nice if you had some sort of simple language that would basically let you say, this is the start of a chapter, and then you type some stuff, and then you say, this is the start of a subsection, and you type some more stuff, this is the start of a sub-subsection, and you don't worry about what they're numbered. You just write them. And then at the end of it, you hit a button and out pops, completely generated, completely automatically, beautifully formatted paper, really nicely typeset, nice anti-aliasing, the whole works. When you print it out, it looks fantastic. It'll automatically generate your bibliography. It'll automatically generate your table of contents. It'll automatically generate your table of figures, should you need such a thing. It'll automatically just number everything, make everything look pretty and perfect. If you reference images, it'll automatically name them, fig, whatever. Make sure all your references match up. Even if you stick in another image later, it'll make all the numbers change. Just keeps track of everything for you. So you just basically write your stuff and you give everything that you want to reference. You just give it a textual name. So you might call it, you know, pick of whatever. And then you say, you know, and as you can see from, and then you just put in /ref pick whatever. And then it'll automatically replace pick whatever with, you know, whether it becomes fig 4, fig 8, fig 20, whatever.
That sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's it's not for all situations. I sort of think of it, if it comes to more than 10 pages, it's probably time to ditch Word and go for LaTeX.
Okay, so for the simple couple of page things, Word is...
I wouldn't bother. Yeah, I really wouldn't bother, because LaTeX really comes into its own the bigger your document gets. Its origin is for typesetting books. That's where it comes from. If you're in the sciences, it has a bunch of extra advantages because it can actually do fancy mathematical equations. So you can get the big, the big S. Is that an integral or differential? It's an integral. It's an integral. Big integral signs and pi's and phi's and deltas and doodads and whatchamajiggers and you name it. Big mad equations, it'll format them all beautifully, give them a reference, so it'll be equation whatever, and then you can reference it in your text. It'll also do tables, you know, it's basically everything.
When you first brought it up, I said my only understanding of LaTeX is how it does equations inside of a wiki, and you about had a stroke when I was so ignorant about it, but it was doing those equations that was really powerful for us inside a wiki.
Yeah, it's certainly a very good aspect of its engine. If you ever see an exam paper for a mathematics course, you can pretty much bet your bottom dollar it was written in LaTeX. And you will get beautiful looking equations with the absolute trivialest amount of effort. It really is quite handy. I have a certain soft spot for LaTeX because it was written by the god of computer science, as far as I'm concerned. A certain chap called Don Knuth. I think he's from California somewhere, probably Berkeley. I'm not 100% sure of that. But the man, basically, he's the world expert on C. And he just, one day, he just got fed up of stuff not coming out right. And he went, I'm going to write a typesetting language. And he did.
Wow.
And he released it completely free and open source.
Oh, it's free? This doesn't cost anything?
Doesn't cost a cent. Completely free and open source.
Wow.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Then you can combine it with something called BibTeX. Now, the bigger your project, the more this stuff starts to come in. Imagine you're working in a really huge document, say a PhD thesis. I can't see why that would jump to my mind. you don't want a single document that is millions of pages long. With LaTeX, you just have a command to say include, and you give it another file. So my actual thesis main file is really tiny, and it just says include chapter 1, include chapter 2, include chapter 3. Then I can have a separate file for each of my bits and bobs and just suck it all into one big file at the end.
Huh. Now, why is that an advantage to have them separate? Just so you're not scrolling and digging around in things?
Yep. They have it in one.
Ah.
It's a lot easier to manage. The other thing is you can have them in separate folders. So I have chapter 1 in a separate folder, chapter 2 in a separate folder, and all of the images and every related bit of file that is needed for chapter 1 goes into the chapter 1 folder. So I don't end up with this giant big mess of everything in one.
Now at the end, so you've got all these disjointed files and graphs, all this kind of stuff in different folders. How do you print it to PDF, or how do you make it go?
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. You can do it all from the command line if you really feel like hurting yourself. Or there's a fantastic sort of, I wouldn't call it a GUI because you're still expected to type the code, but it's sort of an IDE, an integrated development environment. So basically you have a text area and you have a button at the top that says LaTeX, and you click that button and it does some magic and out pops a PDF.
Oh. But you have to type a command to get that window to push that button.
Well, no, there's a nice, it's, I wouldn't call it a GUI because you don't, it's not like Word doesn't have buttons for bold and stuff. You still have to do that stuff yourself.
Right.
But it is a full-blown Mac app, so it's called TechShop.
How do you spell that?
TechShop. We should probably explain, actually, that LaTeX, it is pronounced LaTeX, and it's very important you call it LaTeX. It's spelled capital L, small a, capital T, small a, capital X. Very important.
That sounds easy to type.
Yeah, actually, if you type LaTeX into LaTeX, it formats it into the LaTeX logo.
Is there a reason it's so annoying?
Well, tech is the original thing Don Knuth wrote, and then LaTeX is sort of an add-on to LaTeX, to tech. So I guess that's why the tech bit is capitalized. And then I guess they just put a capital L on the start of the lay because it would look silly if it didn't start with a capital letter.
But why is tech spelled T-E-X and the X is capitalized?
That I'm not sure of, actually. Obviously, it's some sort of in-joke with Don Knuth and someone else, I guess. I'm sure that the internet has the answer somewhere.
So we could leave that as an exercise for the student?
Exactly. The other thing, then, is if you're working on something very big, it's you can have, as well as LaTeX, there's a sort of a companion called BibTeX, which allows you to have a bibliography file, which is basically a little database of everything you ever want to reference. And you keep that file, and then you can just use that same file for all of your different papers and stuff.
Why would you have the same bibliography on more than one paper?
Okay, it's not a bibliography. It's a bibliography database. So it'll only you keep that database forever, and you just keep adding to it and adding to it. And then when you build the paper at the end, it will only suck in the right references.
Ah, I see.
So it'll build a custom bibliography based off of your bibliography database. So you don't have to look up the same reference again and again and again and copy it. You just have your one BibTeX file, and then you use it every paper, and you keep adding to it. And by the end of it, you know, after the end of your university course, you have a giant BibTeX file, which will be absolutely perfect for writing your dissertation because it'll have all of your references in it.
Ah, I see.
Now, the nice thing is there's a little GUI, which is Java-based, I think, but it comes as an OS X app anyway. It's called, what's it called now? Ah, damn. I use it all the time, and I can't remember it. I hate drawing blanks. It must be because it's 2 in the morning.
Wine. That's all you do is wine.
I know. It's called BibDesk, I think. I'll dig up the links for the show notes for everything, actually.
Okay.
And it's a little GUI, so you can actually, instead of having to learn how to mark up a reference, just gives you a little GUI with text boxes. You type in the name of the author, you type in the date, you type in where it came from, and then it just adds it all into this little bib file, and then you can reference it from within your document.
So back us up a little ways. Let's say you want to have a chapter heading that you want it to be bold and underlined, and right after that you're going to, and the chapter heading is my most excellent chapter, and right after that you want to type in regular type, this is my first chapter. So how would you do that?
The first thing is that with LaTeX, it's all of you start the document by saying what kind of document it is. So you give it a style sheet, effectively. It's not called a style sheet, it's called a class. But it's effectively like a style sheet. So you don't really have to worry about markup. If you go to write a journal paper for a major journal, they will have a BibTeX, or they will have a LaTeX style sheet for you. And if not, LaTeX comes with a bunch of standard ones built in, like book and article and a few ones like that. And so you just, at the start of your document, you just simply say that my document class is going to be article or APA if you're writing for the APA journal or whatever. And then from then on, you don't have to worry about what my headings look like. You just have to worry about saying this is a heading and okay. It should be this.
So how do you say this is a heading?
So it'll be / chapter, open curly bracket, the name of the chapter, close curly bracket.
Okay.
So everything in LaTeX begins with a /.
Okay.
All your commands begin with a /.
Oh, commands do. And that way it separates your text from your commands?
Yeah, and then your normal paragraph would just be a normal paragraph. There would be no markup around it at all.
Okay, so...
And every time you leave a blank gap, it means start a new paragraph, and it will format it properly.
Okay, so right after the title, we've just given it. Now we want to start writing in the paragraph. We don't put anything around it? We don't say a
nothing
slash?
Nothing around it, no. No, nothing around it. Compared to HTML, it's very, very little actual markup. With the exception of your headings, it's pretty much type your text. The only time you need to worry about markup is when you come to things like inserting images, inserting bulleted lists, inserting tables, inserting equations, inserting references. And references is really straightforward. Just / cite, open curly bracket, the name of the reference, close curly bracket. Hmm. That's it.
You know, one of the things I've been trying to do is get people to start trying to get away from things like PowerPoint and Word, because I find that you spend so much of your time formatting that you forget to spend time on content.
That's certainly a problem you will not have with LaTeX, because you set your style at the top, you set your style sheet, and then you ignore it. And the only thing you're thinking about while you're writing is the content. So it really is just markup. You're saying what this is, not what it should look like. And the style sheet takes care of that. If at the end, you can write your own custom style sheets as well. So if you get a style you're not entirely happy with it, you can open up the style and tweak it, but you don't have to touch your document again. So step one, write your document. And then if you really absolutely want to, you can tweak it. But to be honest, the default styles are perfect, because this thing comes from an academic world. Its origin is within a university, and that's what it's been doing. It's been used throughout history to write academic papers, write dissertations, write theses, write exam papers, and write books. That's its role in life. So generally, it just works.
You know, one of the things working with Microsoft Word, even if you wanted to, say, have it be a standard set of things, like you didn't want to be creative at all, you wanted, you know, it always to be Arial 24-point or for titles or whatever it was, whatever you chose, and you define your styles in the style definition, you know, and you say, after that style, I want it to look like this. You say, I want it to, you know, right after that, it should always be indented and start with a Roman numeral. Now, I guarantee you that at some point, those Roman numerals will decide that now they're letters A, B, C. And you'll say, No, I really wanted Roman numerals. And Word will say, I'm going with A, B, C. And it doesn't matter how long you fight. You are going to lose and you're going to cry at the end. Well, at least that's how it happens for me.
Yeah, LaTeX is actually very intelligent. When you insert a picture, it doesn't just blindly stick it there in the text. It will be in the text after you first reference it, and it will stick it in where there's room for it. So where it won't be, you know, right off the end of a page, or it won't be half on one page and half on another page. It's very intelligent about where it puts stuff.
Nice.
Which it is actually very nice. Now, it does have a few little eccentricities. For reasons that I haven't quite yet fathomed, you have to run LaTeX on everything twice. So the first time you run it, it finds all your references, and everywhere that you make a reference, it puts a question mark. And then you run it again, and then it knows magically where everything should be, and then it puts in the numbers.
Huh.
So now, it's LaTeX.
So I'm kind of confused. So I thought you were writing in LaTeX. You're talking like you apply LaTeX to a file.
Well, technically you do, because if the file is saved as .tex, but the little IDE just has a button at the top, and you press the button and it calls LaTeX on your file.
Okay, so what are you writing in? Do you just write in a text editor?
You could, if you were really hardcore, pick any text editor you like and then run the LaTeX command from the command line. Or you can use TechShop, which gives you somewhere to write and a button at the top.
Oh,
it says LaTeX.
Okay. So, I thought TechShop was just to print it to PDF. That's where you would actually write.
Well, no, that's LaTeX's whole purpose. That's what LaTeX does, is it gives you out a PDF.
Oh.
So even if you did it from the command line, it would still come out as a PDF.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Huh.
So basically, LaTeX turns a .tex file into a nice shiny PDF.
I see. So what if you want what if you have hyperlinks in your document? What's it do? How's it do those?
I don't think it's not a web-based language. It's meant for printing. The whole point, the reason LaTeX, what LaTeX does really well is it makes stuff look good on paper. Its aim in life is to get stuff onto paper well. So if you print out a Word document, it still has nasty sharp corners and stuff on the letters. The typography isn't very nice. You don't tend to have nice ligatures and stuff. It, typographically, it's actually really crappy from Word. Whereas if you print something out from LaTeX, typographically, it will be beautiful. You know, the italics will be fantastically curvy and wonderfully anti-aliased. And even your regular letters will be beautifully anti-aliased. And it will look really well in print.
Hmm.
So, you know, the purpose, or LaTeX purpose in life is to make printed stuff pretty. And to do it without wrecking your head. Which is important. But like I say, it has its eccentricities, so you have to use the LaTeX command twice. But if you use BibTeX to have your automatic bibliographies, then it's actually a little dance you have to do. LaTeX, BibTeX, LaTeX, LaTeX. Something that every grad student who's ever used LaTeX has that imprinted in their brain. I mean,
let me see if I can. It's LaTeX, BibTeX, LaTeX, LaTeX?
That's it.
LaTeX, BibTeX,
LaTeX, LaTeX. Yeah, and that's, you just have to remember that. So you write your thing, you click the LaTeX button, you click the BibTeX button, you click the LaTeX button twice, and out pops your shiny PDF.
Okay.
Yeah, like it's an investment, because the reality is it's going to take you a little while to get to grips with it, which is why the start of the year is the time to play with LaTeX, not the week before your paper's due. Because I regularly have undergraduate students who are in their final year, and they're coming to me saying, okay, thesis is due in 2 weeks. I want to use LaTeX because I hear it's great. It's like, sorry, too late.
And they've written the whole thing in Word?
Well, no, the being undergrads, they haven't started yet.
Ah,
they're computer scientists. They've written the program or whatever they were meant to do, and now it comes to the English bit. They go, I hear this LaTeX thing is great. You know, should I do that? And it's like, well, how quick of a learner are you?
So it's not a natural instinct then, huh?
No, it entirely depends. If you've done other markup languages like HTML, you're going to find that a walk in the park, because compared to HTML, LaTeX is really, really terse, what's the opposite of terse? Unverbose, whatever, there's a nice word for that.
Succinct or
yeah, exactly.
Crisp or...
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a HTML document, it's angle brackets everywhere.
Right.
If you look at a raw LaTeX file, there's very few commands, and most of it is just text.
Can you do anything else with your raw LaTeX file? Like, could you show me what one looked like? Or
I can send you a LaTeX file, sure.
But if you sent me a LaTeX file, would I be a LaTeX file? Would you be able to
LaTeX.
Would I be able to see it? LaTeX.
LaTeX.
Sorry.
It's just a .tex file. It's just a plain text file with a .tex extension. So it would be like sending you a HTML file. If you just look into it with your editor and see lots of tags.
Okay.
I mean, the only way to turn a text file into something pretty is with the LaTeX command.
Make me a little one. I want to see what it looks like.
Yeah, that's the whole point of the thing is it's not really about little ones.
I know, but I want to see what it looks like. I can't tell what it looks like. I can't feel it yet.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll zip up one of my journal papers and send that to you.
Can I share it with the audience or no?
That's an interesting question. I wonder what the copyright is on published publications.
If you've been paid to publish it?
Well, it's appeared in journals and stuff.
Let's just leave the listeners out. What the heck?
Okay, no, I can definitely send it to you. But
you can't just make one that has like a beginning, a middle, an end, and a couple of chapter markers?
I suppose I could. That's just boring. But no, okay, I'll do that.
Okay. Well, this sounds pretty geeky. No, you said normal students would do this, like somebody writing an English paper would write in this? This sounds like geek land.
Well, the APA use it, and they're very much not geek land.
What's an APA?
The APA, they're a big journal in the States. I think it's the American Psychological Association. I think that's what APA is. I think it's psychology or something that ends with a P, and it's an ology.
Well, it sounds like maybe it's for people who publish things in print.
Well, no, it's exactly. It is for when you have to submit something in print. Its role is not to keep stuff digitally, really, although it does make very nice PDFs. Really, those PDFs are meant to be printed out. I mean, it's for submitting written work.
Okay.
If you want to give it a go, the bigger your project is, the more of a payback you'll get. So if you're facing into writing up a master's thesis or something, and this is absolutely for you, and you set aside a week and you just learn LaTeX, and it will be a skill you'll have for life, and by the end of the year when you hand in your master's, it will have made up all of that time a million times over. But if you have to submit a 2-page document, it's just not worth it.
Okay.
Unless you have to submit like 50 of them or something.
Well, I do need to tell you exactly how I did my master's project. There was a computer that came out, one of the very, very early ones after teletypes, that actually used the VI kind of key commands. And I can't remember what it was called, but it was this gigantic machine. It was probably the size of my desk at work. And it had a wheel with the keys on it. And I typed it all into that and then left blank pages where Steve drew the drawings for me with pen and ink. On to vellum, and then we've typed on the paper with a typewriter the figure numbers. So that was in 1982, I think.
LaTeX would have existed by then.
Really?
Oh yeah, this thing is ancient.
So it would have run on a PDP-11 or something?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Don Knuth would have written it on something like that, yeah. it goes back an awful long way.
That would have been nice. Maybe I'll recreate my master's thesis in LaTeX.
Oh God!
Or maybe not.
How bored are you?
Not that bored. I am going to play with it a little bit. I just want to see what it does. I want to make it go once or twice. Oh, what operating systems does it run on?
Its origins are on Unix, but it will run on Linux, Windows, and Mac as well.
Right, something for everybody. Well, for
something for everyone.
All now, there's PhD students out there, get to work.
Yeah, so if you're running on Windows, you want to get a distribution called MikTeX, which is M-I-K capital T-E-X. On the Mac, if you go to the Tech Shop website, they have instructions for actually installing LaTeX and Tech Shop. So Tech Shop is just like an environment for easily writing your LaTeX in, and it will actually give you instructions for installing the actual core LaTeX as well. And on Linux, I would be pretty sure you just get it from your standard package manager. There's also a nice GUI for editing LaTeX in Linux called Kyle, which you'll like.
All right. Well.
I think the reason it's called Kyle is because the editor for editing ordinary code in KDE is called Kate. So I think, you know, they made another editor and they called it Kyle to go with Kate.
Very nice. All right. Well, like I said, all you PhD students and master's thesis type people, sit down and learn how to use this. And if anybody does use this, I'd sure be interested in hearing from you.
Yeah, and I'm going to give you some links for the show notes, because just where you can download all this stuff.
Great. And I think you're giving us a link to the wiki all about it, too.
Yeah, there's a link to a wiki, then there's a link to where you can download LaTeX itself for the Mac, and a link to BibDesk, which is a nice little GUI for managing your database of references.
Great. All right. Well, thanks, Bart. Have a good weekend with your... you're going to visit family, I think?
I am. I'm off to the sticks, so I'll have no internet, which is why we're recording this now. and then next week, I'm hoping it's business as usual.
All right. Sounds good. Well, have a good weekend, Bart.
Cheers, and until next time, happy computing.
We're getting a lot of fantastic reviews now, and I think it's time to give out some guidelines. Maybe I'll put these on the website somewhere. The audience loves the varied reviews. I get great feedback on all of the different people that we have review. Definitely. I mean, nobody's gotten like this, I hate that guy kind of comment or anything. Everybody loves the review, so keep them coming. Anybody who hasn't done a review, I really want you to do it. But one thing they almost universally don't like is when a review goes on more than about 5 minutes. Even the really, really good ones, I get flack on it when they go too long. So try to keep your reviews in the 3 to 5 minute range, and more people will enjoy it. Now that a lot of people have been able to make their first recording sound really good, I mean really good audio, we've heard like three or four in a row where it's their first audio recording and they sounded perfect, I'd like to ask that you spend some time making sure that you have good sound. Whatever you do, don't use a built-in microphone. They sound dreadful. They pick up a lot of room noise. The first thing we do every time we stand up Ustream is people say, "Allison, your audio is horrible." And it's because I have not gone over and changed it to my microphone. I've got it on system sound. You don't have to spend a lot of money. You really, really don't to get rid of, you know, to get a small, cheapy USB microphone. The other thing is to wear headphones to make your chances of success so much better. Another way you can improve your audio is by sending me uncompressed audio files. If you join Dropbox, you can share a folder with me and then upload those large files, through that method, because you really can't email them very easily. I mean, maybe you can. But if you do an AIFF file out of GarageBand or, you know, whatever tool you're using, a WAV file, they're all good. And that way it's not getting compressed and then sent to me, and then I drag it into GarageBand, and it gets compressed again when I send it out. So if you could send me an AIFF file, that's better, a WAV file, anything that's uncompressed, that's better. The final request is that send me some text and links to your website, your podcast, your Flickr photo stream, whatever it is. Pimp your stuff, guys. Don't miss an opportunity to do this great recording and then forget to tell me that you've got some content online you'd like to tell people about it. Jane did like, what, 6 reviews before I found out she even had a website? And guess what? I found out about it on somebody else's podcast when she was doing it. So it's up to you to send me these in with your recordings. Don't make me go hunting around for them. Send them to me. Pimp your show. That's the whole ticket. Never miss an opportunity to pimp your own show. I think I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when I was at the New Media Expo, this guy I was with was, we were having dinner and this woman was going to do a little recording to check out, you know, just to record us for whatever reason. And he didn't want to stay and do it. I'm thinking, dude, she's giving you free advertising. It doesn't matter if she's got 5 listeners, 500, 5,000 listeners. We all need people to hear what it is we're doing. So pimp your show. Never forget it. So when you send in your recording, and if you don't have a show, you don't have a website, that's cool too. But if you do, let me know about it, okay? Send me a link and I will put it in the show notes. Well, that's it for this edition of the NoSillaCast. Keep up all that great feedback and all those reviews by sending me email at nosillacast@gmail.com. And be sure to check out the Ustream show at around 5 p.m.-ish, GMT minus 8 or GMT minus 27, whatever it is Jane tells me I'm at that time. I think it's GMT minus 8, but I always send out a Twitter, by the way, and tell people, I give them a little bit of a heads up when it's coming out. So follow me at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.